Radio Power for the People. 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Teresa Wilkie. Today, host Keith Brownell will talk with Frank Chapman, a community organizer from Chicago. They'll discuss police brutality and his prison activism. Then, Keith will talk to Hetty Hardin, chair of Missouri Cure, about their conference this Saturday in Kansas City. Frank will be the keynote speaker at the conference. Keith returns in the second half of the broadcast to talk to formerly incarcerated citizens about what it's like behind bars, as well as some family members who struggle to make ends meet and help their loved ones reform and return home again. There will be no calendar of events this week, but we will highlight an upcoming fundraiser for St. Michael's Veterans Center at the end of the broadcast. We want to thank our engineer, Keith Washburn. Now to Keith Brownell and his guests.
September has been an unusually busy month in Kansas City and elsewhere for community activists and advocates of criminal justice reform. This is definitely a trend that needs to continue. Bringing this month's flurry of activities to a close will be Missouri Cure's 15th annual statewide conference on September 29th at the Robert J. Mohart Multipurpose Center. The theme for this year's conference will be Stop Hating the Criminals, Start Hating the System That Produces the Criminals, and Stop the Bleeding. This event will be held at the Robert J. Mohart Multipurpose Center at 3200 Wayne in Kansas City, Missouri. Our keynote speaker will be Brother Frank Chapman, a veteran of the Missouri penal system and a longtime activist for community causes in the city of Chicago. And later, we will also be talking to Ms. Hetty Hardin, who is the chairperson of Missouri Citizens United for the Rehabilitation of Errants, also known as Missouri Cure. My name is Keith Brownell. Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio, and good morning to you, Brother Frank.
Good morning. How are you?
First of all, I would like to ask you if you could give us a little background about yourself and tell us what all you're involved in.
Well, it could take a long time, so I'll try to give you a quick abbreviated version. My background is I was wrongfully convicted at the age of 19 and sentenced to life for 50 years in the Missouri State Penitentiary. I stayed in the penitentiary from 1961 until 1976, at which time I was released on parole. I stayed on parole for 5 years, which means by 1981, I was out of the system completely. Immediately after coming home, I got involved in community organizing, mainly working with the National Alliance Against Race and Political Repression, which is an organization I still work with today. Mm-hmm. And today, mainly the work that we're doing is we're doing mainly community organizing work around the issue of police crimes. And our main mission is to see to it that when police commit crimes, they get punished just like anybody else. You know,
exactly.
They not be excused from punishment because of their badge. And so to make that happen, we have been campaigning here in Chicago now for a number of years to get legislation passed that would empower the people to hold the police accountable for the crimes they commit. A legislation is called Civilian Police Accountability Council, in short, CPAC.
Now, that what you just spoke on a few minutes ago, that seems like that's a disturbing trend all over the country, and it's been in place for quite some time. And over the years, we've been hearing quite a bit about that coming out of the city of Chicago. Now, what do you attribute this trend to be as far as trying to excuse police every time they commit what seems to be obvious acts of murder mm-hmm. and police brutality? What do you think is at the root of this problem?
Well, I think what's at the root of the problem is the way that the police are used in the African-American community. The way they're used in the African-American community is not just simply to be crime busters or stop crime. They're mainly used as a military operation. Which means that they are about the business of maintaining social control in the African American community, as opposed to being crime stoppers. And in carrying out this action, They use deadly force. They use violence in all different kinds of ways. And sometimes they go to extremes where they are totally disrespecting of the constitutional rights of black people. And, you know, sometimes it's resulting in people being killed or brutalized in different kinds of ways. So, in general, the police are there not to serve and protect us. In general, the police are there to maintain social control.
In other words, an occupying force.
Right.
Now, do you see poverty as somehow playing a role in how the police interact with the people in African-American community and the just basically the poor community in general?
Well, you know, we have high unemployment rates in the African-American community. About 50% of our youth is unemployed. There's a high unemployment rate among the adults. There's housing problems, you know, not enough housing, poor living conditions, there's lack of delivery of health services. There's all kinds of problems in the African-American community, which are there as a result of racial discrimination and prejudice, you know. And so, you know, poverty very definitely is connected with this issue because poverty creates restlessness. Poverty creates crime. And so the police are there to address the restlessness and supposedly to address the crime. I don't think that they really address the crime. I think that what they do is they aggravate it.
Well, we know that in these type of situations, the African-American community is hit harder than anybody else in the communities. But doesn't these same conditions also affect poor whites, Latinos, and other people who are underprivileged?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Poor people in general, you know, suffer from these conditions. And that would include Latinos. You know, that would also include a lot of white people. In fact, most poor people in America are white. But now, white people do not get racially oppressed in this country. You know, that's what happens to black people.
Right.
And it also happens to Latinos to a large extent, but it happens to nobody like it happens to us.
Exactly.
Because nobody in this country has the history that we have when it comes to this question. You know, black people did not migrate here looking for jobs. Black people were kidnapped, sold into slavery, and brought here and forced to work for hundreds of years as slaves. And the institutions that were set up to maintain that condition, some of them are still with us today. And one of those institutions is policing, by the way.
Now, I have a two-part question here for you. How long have you lived in the city of Chicago, and how long did you live in St. Louis?
Well, I was born and raised in St. Louis, so I lived in St. Louis roughly from the time I was born in 1942 all the way up until I came home from prison when I was 34 years old, you know. And I've lived in Chicago off and on for the last 10 years, and prior to that, I lived in New York for almost 30 years.
Which of those three places do you think is the worst?
In terms of police crimes?
Yes.
Chicago.
Is St. Louis about equal to what takes place in Chicago? I know it's probably Chicago's probably a little bit worse, but where do you think St. Louis at? Where would you rate them at on this scale?
Well, In terms of quality, I would say that they may be almost identical. But in terms of quantity, Chicago is, I think, the second largest police force in the United States. Mm-hmm. And Chicago has a very large black population, probably 5 or 10 times larger as the one in St. Louis. So it's a bigger problem in Chicago. It's the same problem, but it's a bigger problem, you know, given population size and so on.
Well, knowing the conditions that exist in Chicago, what made you decide to take a residence there?
Well, what made me take a residence here was that I was asked to come in as a community organizer, which I've been doing community organizing for over 40 years. I was asked to come in and help in Chicago in terms of building a movement to stop police crimes.
What are some of the people you've had to work with outside of your
group?
I've
worked with a lot of different organizations. You know, almost every organization that you can think of in the African-American community I've worked with, including the Nation of Islam. I've worked with various black organizations, you know, like Soul. I've worked with some trade union organizations, Chicago Teachers Union, Service Employees International Union. I've worked with churches like Trinity United Church of Christ, which is also the church that Reverend Wright and Obama used to belong to. I've worked with a number of different individuals and organizations build this movement, you know, a movement to stop police crimes in this city.
Okay, now you've been in this type of business for quite some time. Is there any advice you could give to people in the African American community about how to avoid being victimized by the police in these type of situations? What would be your advice?
Well, my advice would be to organize a movement to stop it, because it's not going to stop itself. The police are not going to stop the police. So you need the community to stop it. And so what we've been doing here in Chicago is we've been building a movement to have community control over the police. It's our democratic right to say who polices our communities and how our communities are policed. But that's a right that we're going to have to make happen ourselves. And the way we're trying to make it happen here in Chicago is we're trying to enact legislation, citywide legislation, that will create an all-elected, all-civilian police accountability council, which will be responsible for writing the police manual on conduct, which will be responsible for regulating the police with regard to the use of deadly force, which will be responsible for budgeting the police in terms of the money that's given to them through the city budget, and they will be responsible for negotiating with the Fraternal Order of Police, which is the police's union. So all of these different things have to be in the hands of the people, and the people have to have the power. They have to be enabled to hold the police accountable for the crimes that they commit. Otherwise, these crimes will continue.
Okay, now, say I'm visiting the city of Chicago. I'm driving down the street, and it's probably late at night. I get stopped by the police. What can I do to try to put some insurance on my own safety to avoid having a conflict with the police? Is that even possible?
Well, under the present system of policing that we have in Chicago and in this country, there's not a lot that you can do. We can tell people to, you know, be compliant, to agree with the police, do what they say do, not to resist them in any shape, form, or fashion. We can say all those things, and you still might get your life taken. Because what we're dealing with in this country, and people need to understand it, the police can kill you if they perceive that you are a threat. Whether or not you are an actual threat is a whole other question. But they can kill you under the United States Supreme Court ruling. They can kill you if they think you are a threat, you know. And we have to change that. And the way that we change that is we change that by having community control over the police, where you, me, and every other citizen in the community can say how our community is policed and who polices us. That means we don't want no racist cops in our community policing us. How we're policed, that means that the police be there to actually deal with crime and not be there violating people's constitutional rights.
This is 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. My name is Keith Brownell, and I am talking on the phone with Frank Chatman, who is a community activist against police corruption and brutality and murder in the city of Chicago. Have you had the experience since you've been out of prison to work with other people that you were in confinement with during your stay in the Department of Corrections?
Yes.
And has that been a large number of people, or has it been a small number?
Well, I've worked with a large number of people because I've worked with ex-offenders here in Chicago, Missouri, state of New York, and different parts of the country.
Okay, now, do you have an ex-offender program, or is that just something you do on an individual basis?
No, I usually work with organizations that already have those programs. Our organization, the Chicago Alliance Against Racism and Political Oppression, is not an ex-offenders program, you know. Our program is a program to get people out of prison who've been wrongfully convicted, You know, we work with a lot of torture victims who were sent to prison for crimes that they did not commit, and who were tortured by the police. So that's what I do.
What type of advice could you give to a person that's coming out of prison today?
Well, to get actively engaged with people who are fighting for prison reform, who are trying to bring about constructive change in our community to benefit the people of our community. Also, to try to get with people who are trying to get situations corrected with regard to ex-offenders getting a job, getting employed, because that's very difficult, you know, and you can't, you hardly can't make it happen without help.
Did you have those type of problems when you were released from Department of Corrections years ago?
Absolutely. And I was successful because I had help. Wow. I was released from prison in 1976, and I have not been back since.
That's certainly an outstanding accomplishment, because I tell people all the time that it's a miracle just to be able to make it out of one of those places alive and in good health, and then to be able to stay out here on the street is another miracle within itself.
Because you can't do it without help. It's almost impossible without help.
Now, has there been an increase in the programs that provide help to people that's coming out of prison, or
there
a decrease?
There has not been an increase in those programs. In fact, just the opposite. It's been a decrease.
What we try to do at Missouri Cure is we're trying to change. One of the things we're involved in is we try to change people's attitude about how they view people in prison. You know, and we try to make them see that it's not the things that they're incarcerated for. It's not entirely their fault that the system plays a large role in that. How do you see the system playing a role in helping people be filtered into the criminal justice system or the prison industrial complex, as some people call it? In other words, to be confined, how does the system play a role in setting up people?
Through the way policing is done. Mm-hmm. The police are the cutting edge of mass incarceration. You see the police before you see anybody. Mm-hmm. You see the police before you see the judge, the prosecutor, or the penitentiary. So they're the cutting edge. Mm-hmm. The way that they arrest people, the way that they falsely accuse people, the wide range of authority that they're giving in terms of how they deal with people, you know, all of this here contributes to mass incarceration, particularly if it's done by a racist police force.
Well, don't the prosecutors and the judges also play a role in this?
They play a very important role, you know, because once you've been arrested and once you get into the system, they cooperate with the police 100%.
And in some cases, they even conspire with the police when they know that they have people in.
Yeah, they play a role. Yeah, once you get into the system, you know, they play a role, because the prosecutors, they go along with the police. They have a cop out system. Most of the people who go to jail as a result of guilty pleas, and the reason why that is because I'm talking about black people. That is, they have such a low level of confidence in getting any kind of fair treatment or justice from the system. So they make deals, you know, where the sentencing won't be so harsh, and so forth and so on.
And that's also mainly because many of them can't afford attorneys.
It's because they're in poverty. They're poor.
Well, this has certainly been an interesting conversation, sir. We're looking forward to seeing you on September the 29th at our conference, so you can share some more of your insights with our audience. And I wish you luck in all of your endeavors. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure talking to you.
All right. You too, sir. We're on the phone now with Ms. Hetty Harden, who is the chairperson of Missouri Cure. Could you tell us a little bit about what type of organization Missouri Cure is?
It's a prison reform organization, and we are all volunteers, but we've been in existence in Missouri for 28 years now, since 1990. And we advocate for prisoners and their loved ones. Our mission is to see that prisons are used only for those who must be incarcerated, and that prisoners have all the resources needed to turn their lives around.
And what made you become interested in doing this type of work?
In 1989, I was on a tour of the old Missouri State Penitentiary, and I met a guy there, and I we started writing and then talking on the phone and then visiting. And about 3 years later, we ended up getting married. So I was looking for an organization that would help move things forward in the prison system, would give us a vehicle. And CURE was that vehicle.
Now, does CURE just exist here in Missouri, or does it exist in other places around the country?
So it started out in Texas as Texas CURE in 1972. And then they moved to Washington, D.C., and turned into a national organization and started getting chapters started around the country. And the head of it is a man named Charlie Sullivan. He's a former priest. His wife, Pauline, is a former nun. And they, even though they're not in the religious orders anymore, they took a vow of poverty and they still adhere to it. And they're in Washington, D.C., and we've got chapters, state chapters in most of the states. And in 2000, CURE's turned into an international organization. They had their first international meeting in New York, and now they have meetings around the world in different places.
And that's in addition to these annual conferences that you have here in Missouri, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we just, each chapter is pretty much independent, although we are all of the leaders are on a board and meet yearly.
Now, what type of response have you received from the people here in Missouri since you've been doing work with Missouri CURE?
Well, it was very difficult during the 90s for me to get it started because I was pretty much alone and I was working full-time, and it just was really difficult. But I'm retired now, and Keith Brownell, this other person on the phone here, has become the vice chair, and things have really taken off since then. Keith was a former prisoner himself, and a lot of guys there know him and respect him, and so we've come a long way.
Now, can you tell us about this, a little bit about this conference that's coming up on September the 29th?
This is our 15th annual conference. And it will be on September 29th. That's less than a week.
On a Saturday.
It will be at the Mohart Multipurpose Center. And it'll be all day from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. We have an exciting program in store. We have our keynote speaker is a man named Frank Chapman, who was a legend among Missouri prisoners back in the 70s. He was at Missouri State Penitentiary, and then he had such a profound influence on prisoners that they actually transferred him out of state before they even had an interstate agreement. So he's now in Chicago, and he's very well known and respected, and he fights against police brutality. And they have a big movement going for community control of the police.
Now, what are the requirements for participation in this event?
Anyone can come. No one will be turned away.
Okay.
And it is open to the public.
Okay. Is there any form of planned entertainment or how does the program proceed?
Yes, we have a lot of stuff coming up. It's pretty exciting. We're going to have entertainment, workshops, awards, we provide lunch. It's going to be enlightening and inspiring, I really believe. We have great speakers and just a really good program in store.
Okay, now, these awards, what type of awards will you be presenting and what are the reasons?
We have regular awards that we've been giving out for some years. One is the Courageous Citizen Award. And do you want me to tell you about who's getting it?
Yeah, well, explain what the Courageous Citizens Award is first.
It's for someone who has really gone above and beyond the call of duty out here on the street to just defend the cause of justice. And the young woman who's getting the award, she was trying to defend a child and was accosted by police, and she's definitely deserving of this award. We also have one called the Rory Ellinger Award. He's a former state representative, and he was the first one to file a bill that would take away mandatory minimum sentences and fight mass incarceration in that way. But he died in 2014, so we give an award in his name every year. There's also one called the John Mark Taylor Award, and John Mark Taylor also died a few years ago, but he was an extraordinary prisoner who actually earned a PhD while he was in prison. He was a prison activist and very admirable person. So we give an award in his name every year. And this year, the John Mark Taylor Award will go to our keynote speaker, Frank Chapman.
Well, it does sound like it will be a very inspiring and enlightening event. And we do thank you for taking time to call in and give us some information about this. And
oh, you're so welcome. I hope everybody turns out. We'd love to see you there, and I'm sure you won't regret it.
Yes. With that said, we'll see everybody on the 29th. Thank you very much.
Yes. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Welcome back to Jaws of Justice. On the second half of our program this morning, we will be talking about the impact that incarceration has on family members and loved ones of those who are incarcerated, and the struggle for survival while in prison, and the difficulties of trying to maintain one's freedom and his life after he is released. On the phone, we have Ms. Shirley Miner, who has a loved one who is incarcerated, and Mr. Jesse Scott, who is a former prisoner. Good morning to both of you, and welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you.
I also have in the studio with me my colleague, Macy Jones, who will be co-hosting this show with me today. Okay, Shirley, could you tell us a little bit about your situation and what's actually taking place with your loved one who, first of all, we need to probably know who he is, and then tell us what type of predicament he's been in and what he's had to deal with since he's been in prison and how this had an impact on you.
Okay. Yes, my husband's name is Anthony Miner. He's been incarcerated, and he was wrongfully convicted 25 years ago this past May. And this has been the roughest ordeal I've ever been through, but it's even rougher for him. Dealing with the system, and he's 63 years old now. He recently got sick in prison. They rushed him to the hospital. He had several seizures in June. They got him to the hospital, and they believe it was due to diabetes. But I've been told by some inmates that they walked him out of there. They never put him on a gurney or anything. His best treatment was when he was away from there in the hospital. While he was in there, the fifth day, he had a heart attack, and he flatlined. And after nearly 40 minutes of trying to revive him, he lived through that. But during the time he was there, the entire time, when he was in a coma, they had him shackled to the bed with two guards in the room at all times with guns. This is so inhumane that someone that has a tube in them and in a coma could be shackled. During the time of him being shackled to the bed, his fluids got heavy on him, so, excuse me.
I know. Take your time.
So he had a lot of swelling when he was shackled to the bed. The cuffs were digging into his wrist. I came in one morning, and I asked them if they could please loosen the shackles on his wrist, and that guard that was there be it. After, and I'm not intimidated by guards. What I think should be done, I question things that shouldn't be done. I question and I make phone calls. And that's the thing. The key is to not let our loved ones be there and we do nothing. When they give us information, we should contact whomever we can to make some changes.
Now, did you have any difficulty in acquiring any information about your husband's situation? Were you immediately notified when this happened? And were you kept abreast by the prison administration during his stay in the hospital?
No. My husband has a great relationship with inmates there. And I happen to talk to different people. But anyway, he had not been feeling well, and I talked to him every day before 6 p.m. Well, that particular day, I had not spoken to him, and I called, and something told me to call. And but they they would not give me any information about what was going on. And the guard that answered the phone was going back and forth like she was having conversation with somebody else, telling her what to say to me, because I guess they didn't know what to say. And since I was calling, and they, their rules, this is what they I was told by the administration, that DOC rules are not to contact the family whenever, each time the prisoner goes to the hospital, because they could, this is what they told me, because they could come right back. There's no need for us to know that. And I said, well, what if they don't come right back? And regardless, we can't go to the hospital anyway. So why can't we be contacted? And they said, well, that's just their policies. Mm. When I found out that he was in the hospital, they told me that I could not see him unless he was critical. And I said, you mean to tell me my husband's in the hospital and I can't see him one day? And they told me no, that was against their policy. But if he made a turn for the worse, they will contact me and I'll be able to see him. That's only on his dying bed. And I stated to them that that is so backwards. That if someone is sick, then they would need to see someone. Maybe that'll help them get better. And, okay. So
not only is it
meantime,
backwards, but it's
I called
very
every day that he was in the hospital, or I was contacted by the medical unit supervisor. That's how I got information. That Friday, when he turned for the worse, they called me and told me that they were given permission by the superintendent to contact me and tell me I can come down and visit my husband.
Okay, so you were at home at the time that they contacted you in St. Louis, right?
Correct.
And if he had taken a turn for the worse, and it's very likely that you probably wouldn't have been able to get there in time before he passed away. Is that right?
That's correct. Mm-hmm. I just happened, my son and I went down after I received that phone call, which was so nerve-wracking to drive over 2 hours, not knowing what I was going to find when I got there. And they let me visit for a half an hour when I got there, and he was in ICU because it was not visiting hours. They were just accommodating me for coming down.
So how is he doing now?
Now, He's a lot better. I would say he's probably 88% back to himself. But it's like this was, my husband was a man that stayed busy and stayed working out, playing handball. And he has not been able to do that. It's like somebody has just dimmed his light some.
He's a different person now.
Yes. He has numbness in his hands, his wrists, from the handcuffs being on so tight and circulation being cut off.
Okay, I think I want to...
I want to add one more thing.
Go ahead.
When he returned to the prison, he was in the infirmary. He had a heart monitor on him when he left the hospital, which they showed him and the guards how to work it. The life vest had to be changed, and had to be changed every other day. They were sending another one along with it. It was nearly 2 weeks before that was taken off for him and given another one. there was no exercise. He didn't do any walking until I contacted them about, you know, he's not. Even if you're in the hospital, once you start feeling better, they tell you it's good to get up and walk. And I asked him about that. He said, well, it's not a lot of space. So I told him, I need you to walk or walk in place, move your arms, stretch. And I contacted medical about him walking. And they told me that he had to request that.
This is while he was in the hospital or at the prison infirmary?
At the prison in the infirmary. Mm-hmm. No, I have no complaints of the treatment that he received while he was in the hospital. And he doesn't either. For the most part, he remembers most of the things, but a lot of things he does not remember from the hospital. But he does. He told me at the hospital that the entire staff was really great to him.
Well, we certainly thank you for sharing your story with us, and I'm sure that he is not in a situation all by himself. If that's happening to him, it's probably a pretty good chance that it's happening with quite a few other people, too. And, in fact, I can probably say that I know for a fact that it is because I've talked to other family members and things who weren't able to be here on the show today, and they have similar complaints that sound a whole lot like yours. So. Mm-hmm.
That's correct, Keith. That is true. It's a whole lot of medical issues that are not truly being addressed as they should be addressed. And it's a lot of people suffering behind that fact.
Yeah, we get those complaints all the time over at Missouri Cure. And let's get a little perspective from somebody who's been in the institutions and can talk about some of the things that he's had to go through and his struggles as far as coming back out on the street once he was released. Salon, I think I'll let you talk to Jesse about that.
How you doing today, Jesse?
I'm pretty good, myself.
Oh, I'm doing all right. Being released myself, I know that the trials and tribulations that come with that. While you was incarcerated, how did things go for you?
Well, first off, I want to say this to Shirley, that I pray that Anthony is better. You could be my Shirley. I know him well. He's outspoken. And everything that she said about him, he was very active. Health-wise, he was. And to hear that happen, you know, it brings back, you know, memories that are not too pleasant. Because we have a system in place. Also, she'll let him know I'm praying for him.
Thank you.
The system is designed to not take care of your medical needs, just like to put a Band-Aid on it, so to speak. The Department of Corrections, they contract their medical services. I think it was Corizon when I was there. And they are allotted so much money per day for each prisoner. And each day that one prisoner doesn't use it, I mean, that's a profit for them. So therefore, they're not really concerned about your health issues. I was there for 31 years. Was released in October 2015 after 31 years. Once again, for a crime that I didn't commit. Every time I would go before the parole board, they would tell me, well, according to this, you shouldn't be here. But we cannot re-adjudicate the case, so therefore we're talking about your particular conduct here, which for 25 years, all I did was program, wrote programs, and tried to make things better in the different institutions. Every time they would become better, I would get transferred to another institution, and so forth and so on. As far as the health issues, in 1998, I started having a problem. There was a growth on my right testicle, and I kept saying something is wrong. Each time I go over, they'd tell me, okay, well, we'll give you some ointment. We'll do this, that, and other, but nothing was happening. So finally, when I was transferred from Crossroads to Potosi, and they told me the same thing in Potosi, they finally transferred me to Licking, and there was a doctor, and I got his name, Dr. Scott. And he asked me, have you ever had a bath? And I said, no. He said, you've been complaining about this in 1998, and at the time it was 2009. He ordered a biopsy, and they found out that I had skin cancer. Well, luckily, I went and they got it excised, but there was another mark on my right, in the right thigh, and the pathologist saw there's nothing, there's just irritation. Well, 3 years later, they found out that it was also skin cancer. Once again, with the grace of God, they took it out. Due to follow-up, I didn't have anything else. Well, I started having problems. And they told me as I was getting older, it was probably enlarged prostate and so forth. And finally, someone said, well, we'll see what's going to happen. So I was transferred to Algoa before I was released. And it was all female staff. And most of the time, they felt that if a male came over or anything below his waist, he was some kind of creep or something. And so it was like all passed over. Well, finally, when I was released, I immediately went to a doctor, and I was diagnosed with prostate cancer. But at the time, once again, through the grace of God, it was caught early enough where I had radiation, hormone and radiation treatment. And 3 years later, two and a half years later, I'm cancer-free. But the fact of the matter is, everything that I see to them, the doctors, how they told me, that everything that you told them should have been a red flag. They should have doing these things, but they wouldn't do them. And they said that was 100% wrong. It was against all medical protocol. But this is the Department of Correction.
Okay, can you talk a little bit about your experiences that you've had after you were being released, some of the difficulties you had coming, being reintegrated back into society?
Yeah, when I came back, sadly, I was blessed. I had a lady who had been with me the whole time I was in prison because she knew that I was not guilty of the case that I was charged with. She opened up her home to me, and immediately, 1 week after I was out, I started working at a restaurant called Sweetie Pies. Well, they don't pay you anything, but you have to have a job. And I was 67 when I was released, with $76 in my pocket. And so now I got to work at a job making $8 an hour. And it was hard, extremely hard, to try to make ends meet. And each time I would try to go and get jobs that I'm qualified for, it was your ex-convict and your age. And after a while, I could not make, they cut my hours down to speed fast, so I could not make a living, so I was forced to get on SSI. And the thing that gets me is that I am healthy enough, not extremely healthy, but healthy enough to work at that particular time. And each time that I would try to put in for a job that I was qualified for, the age and the fact that I was an ex-convict. So what I did, I said, start doing things alone. I started going to organizations, and I started mentoring Toastmasters groups and started trying to speak to different people, trying to keep people out of prison. That gave me the strength to persevere, because you are without a job, without anyone trying to give you assistance. Of course, you think about, well, I'm not going to be out here hungry. I'm going to go back to doing what everyone else does. But it takes strength. And it was hard. I was able to persevere. But it was very hard to say, well, now I got to learn how to live off of $3 or $4 in my pocket, learn how to sacrifice, learn how to do things when you have the ability. And there are agencies, but the agencies that should help you, they don't. You're an older guy, don't want you to go get this, why don't you do this? And it's very frustrating, and it's very offending, offensive, when you know at the time you come out, because you refuse, although the health care is bad in there, but if you start trying to do a little something for yourself, you can maintain a little health, and you're able to come out. But you're like, no, you can't. And you are put off into a society. I do want to say this to you. You're put off here in a society after 31 years, and everything has changed. I got a phone, and it took me some months just to learn how to operate. And everything is so, I mean, seriously, it looks like everything is stacked against you when you come out in the streets. Yet, they're saying you have paid your dues to society. I don't understand that.
I can relate to that experience that you just talked about a few minutes ago, because, like, when I went to prison, they had those vending machines where you pulled a little handle out and it snapped back, and the candy or whatever you was ordering, it fell out. I got out of prison, they had these machines where you push buttons and all this type of stuff, and it took, I had to stand there and try to figure out how this stuff actually worked, man. I'm saying it was extremely frustrating. You know, now we don't have but a few minutes left, and I want to take time to remind everybody about our conference that we're having, Missouri Cure Conference, on September 29th. It'll be on a Saturday, so if you're off and you don't have to work, we would appreciate people coming by and taking the interest in what we have to share with them, because we have some really important issues that we would like to go over. One of the things I want to emphasize is that you just heard Salam sit here and say that he went to prison for a crime he didn't commit. You heard Jesse say he went to prison for a crime he didn't commit. You heard Shirley say that her husband was in crime for went to prison for a crime he didn't commit. Now, people tend to, I know there's a tendency by people to still say, well, everybody in prison claims they're innocent. Well, I wouldn't take that and dismiss that too lightly, because nowadays that's more true than it ever was. You know, it used to be a time when you heard people say, man, I'm in prison for something I didn't do. You kind of look at him kind of cross-eyed and say, yeah, right. But nowadays, the way that the system handles these criminal prosecutions, you know, it's very likely that a lot of there are more people in prison that you think about than you would think there are. So please come and try to see us on the 29th. We have to get off the air. And I thank Shirley and I thank Jesse for being on the show with us. And I also want to thank Frank. Your insight as far as what needs to be done about the system is very helpful. And we have some more of that information to share with you at the conference.
This is Jeff Humfeld, and I'm here with Roland Norris. Roland is here to tell us a little bit about the Celebration of Heroes Guardians Awards. This is a benefit for St. Michael's Veterans Center. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what St. Michael's is and how it came about?
One of the primaries there at St. Michael's said, and his name was Brian, if you find a veteran that's homeless, we may not have room for him here, but bring him down anyway, and we'll make sure they're not homeless by evening. I guess if anybody could be accused of being a benefactor of St. Michael's, it's probably Art Fillmore. this has been his baby all along, but not to say that there haven't been a lot of other people involved, too. Well, the Corvette Club of Kansas City, it's going to be our charity for 5 years now. I think we've got one more year to go, and then we'll have to decide if we're going to stay with St. Michael's, which we probably will, or if we're going to try to find somebody else.
Well, what is the purpose of St. Michael's?
It's to get these guys off the street. Most of these guys are veterans. They've suffered maybe numerous traumas, and they finally got a roof over their head, and it's a nice place to stay. It's close to the Veterans Hospital. Disabled American veterans come by twice a day to pick the residents up that need to go to the VA hospital, drop them off, and then they'll bring them back. But the whole idea behind St. Michael's is to honor the people that have actually signed that blank check for anything and everything up into and including their lives for their country. You can get tours through St. Michael's. You'll see what a really great experience that it is.
They sit up on the hill above Leeds Traffic Way and Cleaver Boulevard.
Yeah.
You kind of go up the little hill there where it intersects with 39th Street, and just before you get to 39th Street, you'll see the drive and go in there.
Right.
They have two buildings now and getting ready for their third building.
Yeah, they're getting ready for phase three now. Everybody's looking forward to that. As you'd mentioned before, they're going to have some other things there too.
Yeah, I think they'll have like psychiatric services. And also, I think this third building is kind of a community center. Let's talk a little bit about the Celebration of Heroes Guardians Award. This is going to be November 14th at the National World War I Museum from 5 to 7 p.m. This is a fundraiser for St. Michael's. Do you know where people would get information on?
If they get a hold of St. Michael's Veterans Center, Susan Engel, they'll give them all the information that they need. They'd be very happy to talk to them about it.
And her name is Susan Engel. And her phone number is 816-921-0201. Her email address is S-E-N-G-E-L, that's S-Engel, at smvets.org. So that stands for St. Michael's Vets.org. This is a dinner and an award ceremony.
There are like four different categories that you can nominate veterans for. If you know anybody, then you can nominate them for one of the awards.
And you would do that by contacting Susan.
Right.
Well, Roland, we want to thank you for coming in today, and hopefully we'll get a bunch of people out to this event.
Well, thanks very much. Well, we certainly appreciate your time.
One, two, three.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Monday Morning Medicine Show with Dr. Mike, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.